Dr. Megan Heberton is an assistant professor of dermatology at UT Southwestern Medical Center and founder and director of the Oncodermatology Program at Simmons Cancer Center. Please welcome Dr. Heberton.
Good morning. Thank you so much for inviting me to participate in your conference. I'm really honored to be here, and I'm so excited to hopefully get you motivated to know more about this field, maybe get more involved in it. And I really feel like there's so many different ways we could partner together to take care of these patients. Just for my benefit, can you raise your hand if you have experience in oncodermatology, familiar with the field at all? Okay, so excellent. We will be discussing extensive off-label medication use. That's the primary disclosure for this talk. So today, I really want to cover what is oncodermatology. I want you to understand how to categorize cancer therapeutics for toxicity assessments. That's one of the primary goals of an oncodermatology visit. Understand how to grade immune-related adverse events. Review the scope of immune adverse events, and we'll go over some really great cases. And then review considerations for toxicity attribution. The primary focus of this talk is going to be immunotherapy. There are really a lot of different facets of oncodermatology, but immunotherapy is really what made the specialty explode. So that's what I want you to be primarily familiar with after today's talk. So what is oncodermatology? Well, I run a supportive service to manage the cutaneous concerns of patients that have advanced cancer. I am passionate about partnering with patients while they're living with cancer and helping them deal with the skin side effects that come up. So sometimes what I see patients for has absolutely nothing to do with their cancer. But the patients really appreciate when they're going through something so momentous in their lives, if you have an awareness of what they're going through with their cancer treatments. Now, a big part in what we're going to focus on today is cancer drug and therapy toxicities. That's what really made the specialty necessary. I also treat graft versus host disease, paraneoplastic disorders, and sometimes cutaneous metastases as well. So these are the critical parts of an oncodermatology toxicity visit. What is the mechanism of the drug that the patient is on? Sometimes I don't even know the answer to this, and I have to look it up. But what I have found and what I would advise you is it's not usually a great idea to ask the patient going through all these treatments, what is the mechanism of the drug that you are on? Because they lose faith in you quickly. And this is something that we can look up ourselves. And so part of building that confidence with the patient is having an awareness of what they're going through. What's the morphology of the skin disease that you're seeing? Just like any other realm in dermatology, morphology is absolutely critical to getting the right diagnosis. When we look at those two together, what's the likelihood that the drug is responsible for what we're seeing? Is it responsible for what we're seeing, or is it totally unrelated? How should we grade it? And then, do we need to do anything about it? What can we do about it? These are the critical parts of the visit. This is my approach of how we categorize cancer pharmacotherapeutics. It's a very simplified approach, but to me, it helps me think about what is the spectrum of disease that I might be seeing. So what we're going to be talking about today primarily is immunotherapy. So those are novel treatments where the immune system, the patient's own immune system, is manipulated to help fight cancer cells. This means that adverse events are extremely unpredictable because we're dealing with a disinhibited immune system. So the primary example of this and what you're going to run across mostly in your clinics are immune checkpoint inhibitors. But there's other examples too, like newer treatments like CAR-T or cancer vaccines. Targeted therapies have been around for longer in cancer pharmacotherapeutics. And that's when you'll see that a patient has a specific mutation checked for in their malignancy. And if that's positive or found, then the oncologist knows that if they target that mutation, perhaps they can also fight the cancer. So these are very specific, reproducible ways that we fight cancer, which means that we get specific, reproducible rashes. So if I give somebody an EGFR inhibitor, I know the list of things that could happen to that patient. That doesn't mean that every patient that gets that drug is going to get those side effects, But the list is more succinct. Like, I can tell you from the get-go, I can counsel that patient on these are the things that you may see when you're on this drug. Cytotoxic therapy is what you guys and I think about when we talk about chemo. So if somebody's on chemo, that means that they're on cytotoxic therapy if you're talking to an oncologist. That's when rapidly dividing cells, metabolic profiles of tumors, are targeted. So even though these do create rashes and side effects, there's a lot less that I can do about it. It's a lot of supportive care, because if you get the drug, it's going to happen. If you don't, it's probably not going to happen. So this is very nonspecific, not as immunogenic as some of the other categories, which have made this specialty necessary. And then hormone therapy, that's like your patient on tamoxifen or your patient on Lupron for prostate cancer. When hormones play a large role in driving the pathophysiology of the tumor, we target the hormone pathway. Those have some side effects in skin, but again, much more supportive care when we're talking about therapies. So now let's focus in on immunotherapy, which is what we're going to do for the rest of our session. And immunotherapy has totally revolutionized cancer treatment. This is a different disease. All these diseases have totally changed now that we have immunotherapy. So the preclinical work, I mean, it just gives you a sense of how long it takes these things to go through. The preclinical work on CTLA-4 inhibitors started in the 1990s. We got the first approved CTLA-4 inhibitor in 2011, and then PD-1 inhibitors followed in 2014. And PD-1 inhibitors you're more likely to engage with in your practice just because the risk-benefit profile of CTLA-4 inhibitors means that patients can't stay on those drugs for as long. And this is just a list of some of the most common immune checkpoint inhibitors that you're going to see. It's tough. I was talking about somebody with this about somebody earlier. When you get a med list from a patient, usually this isn't going to be on it, right? Because this is something that's given in an infusion setting. So this is something that the patient may have to tell you, like, I'm taking this drug, and then you would have to look that up and say, oh, okay, this is pembrolizumab or nivolumab. The way derm has interfaced with this historically has been through melanoma, because we know that now immunotherapy is approved for melanoma and has totally changed that diagnosis, right, for our patients. If you had melanoma 15 years ago, your treatment and prognosis is vastly different than if you have it now. But you're going to see those patients on ipilimumab with a PD-1 inhibitor, so a CTLA-4 PD-1 combination. They do that for 4 cycles, and then they're going to move into single-agent PD-1 inhibitor. So you may engage with a lot of melanoma patients who are on these therapies, but one thing I want to bring up is that really there's a vast, extensive list of malignancies that have immunotherapy approved for them. It's not just melanoma patients anymore, so really many patients with metastatic malignancy are going to be on these treatments. I don't want to get too bogged down in details, but basically, usually cancer cells are very good at turning off T cells through the interaction of PD-1 and PD-L1. And the way that these drugs work is they remove that off switch. So they are disinhibiting T cells, which therefore allows those T cells to fight malignancy, fight the tumor cells, kill the tumor cells. Now, we know that T cells do a lot of other things in our bodies. So if we are disinhibiting T cells, it makes sense that we would get immune-related adverse events. Similarly, CTLA-4 does the same thing just through a co-stimulatory molecule. And as I've alluded to before, these drugs have totally revolutionized cancer outcomes. So median survival wasn't even reached in the CheckMate trial in advanced melanoma. There's so many other malignancies like renal cell, which previously had just a horrendous prognosis, that can now become a chronic disease. So this is something that is super important to our patients. Immune-related adverse events are not just restricted to the skin. Our skin is one of our largest immune organs, so of course it's the most common site that we see adverse events. So this is why these patients are going to show up in your clinic. It is almost a predictable side effect of being on immunotherapy. But there are other things that can happen too. Patients can get colitis. They can get endocrine side effects like hypophysitis, interstitial lung disease, and even rheumatologic concerns. Just because a patient gets one doesn't mean that the patient is going to get many others. So really these people become extremely diagnostically complicated. You have to have a really open mind when you're taking care of these patients because all sorts of things are on the table that may or may not be related to their therapies. There are wide estimations and variation in terms of how frequent immune-related adverse events happen, 20 to 40%. When I see something like that, it tells me, like, we don't really know, except that it's quite common, okay? And we know that the skin is the most common. So I will say that now so many patients get immunotherapy that a lot of them don't meet me before they start because there's just so many. But I do meet a lot of them pretty soon after they start, and I tell them, like, look, our relationship may be more of a gen-derm visit. I may just be doing skin checks for you. But if something happens, I'm here for you. I understand what's going on with these drugs with your skin. And it could get very busy. So we'll see what we have to do in the future. The other thing to remember is if you have a patient who has morbilliform eruption to penicillin, whenever you give that patient penicillin, they're going to get the morbilliform eruption, right? We know that's how. It's how the immune system works. These drugs, your timeline is out the window, okay? When you start an immunotherapy drug, it doesn't mean that like 10 days later they're going to start getting rash. I see patients that after a year on therapy get something that is completely attributed to their immunotherapy. So again, these patients require really longitudinal monitoring. We also know that, you know, a lot of the data is from early studies where oncologists were running these studies. Think about what gets counted as rash in your ICD-10 when you're coding for your visits. That's a whole spectrum of diagnoses. And so a lot of times when we're looking at this data as to how often rash occurs, I don't really know if that, what that oncologist or what that study team was seeing was really related to the drug or not, because I can tell you that a lot of the patients that are referred to my clinic for rash and immunotherapy end up having stasis dermatitis. So that is not something where we have to stop nivolumab. But maybe in the trials, they didn't have access to a dermatologist. So this is something where we can really add to the literature. What can happen on these drugs? I think I've already said this and alluded to this. So many of our diagnoses have been reported. There's been sort of a renaissance over the last 10 to 15 years of just discussing what we even see to patients who are on these therapies. And whenever I give talks to oncology teams or other providers taking care of these patients, what I try to point out to them is that this is like my entire specialty, okay? This is like all the training that we have gone through is to try and tell other people, tell patients, what's the difference between these things. We know that all of these diagnoses are diagnosed and treated and triaged extremely differently, right? The patient with bullous pemphigoid is not the same as the patient with psoriasis. So there's so much expertise we can add in taking care of these patients so that they're not put on sort of standardized algorithms, usually that end up on prednisone, which may not be appropriate for a lot of these things. So I'm going to move on now to grading the eruption, meaning how bad is what is going on? How do we talk to other team providers about what is going on with the patient? The language that you need to use and be familiar with, or at least have heard of, is the common terminology criteria for adverse events. This is what oncologists use when they're in clinical trials to help determine the severity of eruptions or any adverse event that a patient experiences. So if you use this language, they're going to understand what you're talking about. It was developed for clinical trials so that it could be standardized, and it does have some pitfalls, but we'll go through those in a minute. So this is the most vague overview of a skin CTCAE score. And actually, these are, I mean, you can access this online. CTCAE scores have been developed to be diagnosis specific. So if somebody has psoriasis, there's a CTCAE score for that. If somebody has a bullous eruption, there's one for that too. Hair loss, there's one for that as well. But this I wanted to put as an example of sort of the most generalized one. And you can see grade 5 is death. Grade 0 is nothing, and then we have kind of variations on a spectrum in the middle. I tried to put below here the action that is going to take place if you communicate that that's what's going on with your patient, or what you should be thinking about doing with the patient if you have a patient with a severity in this level. So if somebody has a grade 1 eruption, you're going to be doing supportive care. If somebody has grade 3, if you say that, the patient's probably going to end up on steroids. They're going to get dose interrupted on their immunotherapy, then we move from there. It is possible if somebody starts at a grade 3 and gets to a grade 1 that they may be able to be rechallenged on immunotherapy. But what I would remind you is immunotherapy, the way that it works, even if we stop immunotherapy, if somebody has a severe eruption, they stop their immunotherapy, that doesn't mean that the eruption is going to go away. Okay? It's not, again, like I gave this person penicillin, they got a rash, I stopped the drug, the rash went away. It's not like that. We are actually reprogramming the immune system. So the patient that develops bullous pemphigoid may just have bullous pemphigoid now. They may have that for years to come. So giving them topical steroids and saying, oh, they stopped your drug, it's going to be okay, that might not be enough. We have to partner with these people to think about longitudinal management and see the trajectory of their eruptions. One thing I want to draw your attention to that is so important is that a lot of the CTCAE score is divided based on body surface area. However, it's very important to remember that you can have a very low body surface area, but if it significantly affects your activities of daily living, your quality of life, that's going to up your score. Okay? We see that all the time with mucosal disorders. It's something really important to remember when you're talking about severity. It's harder to apply this for benign rashes. I think we've all seen patients with psoriasis of a fairly high body surface area that we're sitting there thinking, there is so much I can do about this. I promise I could make it go away. And they just don't, they're not that bothered by it, right? So if somebody like that in a clinical trial setting, you're gonna find that the oncologist is like, yes, but they have a lot of rash. And you're standing there like, yeah, but it's not that big of a deal. But there's kind of a problem there in terms of bodies, like they can't get their grade down because of the body surface area. And so there's more discussions to be had there. CTCAE also for those types of patients tends to encourage steroids interventions, which isn't always the best answer for our patients. So I wanted to demonstrate a case here, a 55-year-old female who had a PD-1 inhibitor for cervical cancer, and she had genital lichen planus attributed to her immunotherapy. She has less than 1% body surface area, but has pain, dyspareunia, and difficulty going out of her home. What would her grade be? So the answer to something like this would actually be grade 3, because she can't go out of her home. She can't do normal functional activities of daily living. This is a low body surface area, high grade. Super important to remember. So now let's look at some great cases, different types of eruptions that I've taken care of just to try to give you illustrative examples. First, I want to talk about lichenoid eruptions. This is a spectrum of disease. I see patients that have just their SKs get a little more inflamed. If you biopsy them, there's some lichenoid inflammation under the path. I also see patients with fulminant eruptions, but it's not quite lichen planus. They're more almost like that lichenoid drug eruption where if we biopsy them, maybe some eosinophils, high body surface area, but maybe just a little bit itchy. Then I see classic lichen planus, some patients just with mucosal disease, some patients with extensive skin and mucosal disease. Now the literature would suggest that this is not typically therapy limiting. I have a referral bias because of what I do. I have seen patients where this is just a horrendous diagnosis for them where I cannot get it under control. I can think of like a couple off the top of my head and it scars me because, you know, I'm like, oh, but it's lichen planus, but it's so morbid for people. The other thing that I run into is we don't have a lot of great FDA-approved therapies for lichen planus. There's so many for psoriasis, eczema, but when we're talking about lichen planus, we go into the wild west of off-label medication use very quickly. So those are kind of complicated discussions to have with patients living with active malignancy. Don't forget to look at the mucosa of your patients with any sort of lichen planus on their skin. Oftentimes they thought that they just had apathy because they were on cancer treatment, but it's actually mucosal lichen planus. So this is an example of a patient who had a lichenoid eruption. He was on treatment for metastatic melanoma with a PD-1 inhibitor, which is a type of immunotherapy. And you know, this is a great example of how he had a really high body surface area, but he could care less. He just wanted to go out, kind of live his life, go on his boat. And so I had to do a lot of counseling more with the oncology team, like, yes, there's a lot of rash, but it's okay. Like, this is not a big deal. I offered this gentleman phototherapy. He didn't want to do it. He was fine with just some triamcinolone every once in a while. He was also really interesting because He was on active treatment for metastatic melanoma, but he kept making new primary melanoma. I think I diagnosed 3 on him in 1.5 years, but his metastatic disease was doing great on immunotherapy, which again, there's a whole other talk there, right, about the biology of new primary melanomas versus metastatic melanoma. But he was one of the most complicated skin exams that I've had because he had so much inflammation going on in his skin, tons of SKs, new melanomas, and then also a primary melanoma we were looking out for. So I always told him he was one of my, I was always going to remember him. This is a patient who was on a phase 1 clinical trial. And remember, when we're on a clinical trial, the rules are very strict. They would not let me have gotten away with what the prior guy had, because that would have been counted as a grade 2 or 3. They would have had to keep dose reducing. He probably would have ended up off trial. But this patient was sent to me as a stat same day consult because there was concern for a bullous eruption. If you guys look at this, I imagine that you can see that sort of silvery reticulated scale. It does not get much better for this, for the polygonal papules on the volar wrist for lichen planus. So I was able to reassure, say, you know, she was already on 1 mg/kg steroids when she met me, got her off of steroids, but I was much more aggressive with her treatment because I wanted to keep her on trial. When somebody is on an early trial like that, you do have to talk with what is allowed in terms of immunosuppression, immunomodulatory agents, through the trial parameters, because those are very controlled. But I was able to put this patient on acitretin and phototherapy concurrently. She had a fantastic response, went down to grade 0, was able to stay on her trial, keep getting rechallenged with drug, and have total cutaneous disease control. This is a great success story. This patient came to me for refractory oral ulcers. She had had an oral squamous cell and was on immunotherapy for that indication. She was on it in the adjuvant setting. And so what sometimes I found is when patients aren't on it for primary metastatic disease control, but really like a boost to try and ensure continued disease control, the oncologist threshold for stopping that immunotherapy is understandably lower. Right, because they view it as like a victory lap, almost. So this is a patient who had been stopped on therapy, but she kept getting oral ulcerations. And what I really wanted to point out here is that in terms of the morphology, this is absolutely beautiful for the gingival disease that we can see in lichen planus, which if you don't know what you're looking for, you could sort of attribute to like poor dentition or something like that. You can see where she'd had her oral SCC and radiation changes in the left buccal mucosa there. But then if you look at her superior gingiva, you can see, again, those reticulated white patches. And then also, please look and appreciate on her vermilion lips. She has total involvement of all of her vermilion lips of lichen planus as well. This was extremely morbid for her. I put her on topical steroids. I use clobetasol gel in the mouth. I always have to counsel that the pharmacy is going to tell the patient that that is not safe, but that they should nod and take the prescription anyway, because it works. It really does help. I talked to her about dentition. So many of these patients that have oral mucosal disease are reticent to get their dental work done because it hurts. But we do know from data, right, that if you have poor dentition, it's going to drive your lichen planus. And so keeping up with the dentist, getting the disease control that they need with their dental hygiene is so important. And I put her on acitretin as well because of her refractory disease. She had a fantastic response. She stayed on immunotherapy for a little while and then stopped, and she had durable lichen planus remission, was able to taper off of the acitretin, and she was just using topicals as needed. Sometimes we see zebras. I don't think I'd ever encountered a true case of lichen planus pemphigoides when I was in training, but I've now had a cohort of them in my patients on immunotherapy. And I think about this in patients that have sort of eruptive lichen planus, that then they get a little like blistery or they're very, very itchy. So my threshold to check an immunofluorescence in these patients is low. There's actually no good data on how to treat lichen planus pemphigoides, so I'll have to give you an update after I do a few more of these. But I've tried both Th1 suppression and Th2 suppression, because if you think about it, it's really an interesting combination of diagnoses that we're dealing with there. This patient I was able to control on acitretin. He had an angiosarcoma and was on an immunotherapy for that. He had had an angiosarcoma for years. He he was living with this, like, usually extremely high mortality diagnosis. So it's really important to be able to keep him on that. With acitretin, able to keep him on his immunotherapy and get this rash under control. Less accurate numbers from prevalence can be highly symptomatic. It's very common referral to my clinic. One of the first things I think about. I've mentioned briefly, but think about topicals, narrowband UVB. I love that because I can tell them, like, no, this is safe for your malignancy. It's an easy discussion, right? Acitretin, of course, we have to do lab monitoring with that. And then there are some studies, like I said, we go off label quickly when we're talking about lichen planus. But if those don't work, I will think about doing something like apremilast because I can usually get it approved with some of the reports that exist in the literature and maybe an IL-17 inhibitor. So this is a real case that I had, a 63-year-old male on nivolumab for metastatic melanoma. So he's on immunotherapy. I had treated him for a year for ICI-associated lichen planus. And then he didn't see me for a few months, and he came back and he looked like this. And if I hadn't taken care of this patient for that year, I totally would have been like that obnoxious person. It's like, oh, they were seeing an outside provider. They were probably doing the wrong thing. Because he looks like this, and this does not look like lichen planus. And I was so confused. I was like, this is the same patient, isn't it? But in the interim, he had changed immunotherapies. They had decided to go from something like nivolumab to pembrolizumab. Now, those are both PD-1 inhibitors. Those are the same class of medication. But the morphology of his rash had totally changed. So it's so important not to get tunnel vision for these patients, okay? If this had been in a MyChart message, you didn't have a photo, you'd say, oh, just go back on your acitretin, right? Would not necessarily have helped with this, because this is prurigo nodularis. I had never seen somebody switch like that so quickly. So I did a biopsy, also consistent with prurigo nodularis. And I switched this guy. This is the question that I was going to ask you, but what would you do next? I put him on dupilumab because now he has prurigo nodularis. He has a new condition. We have to treat it like the condition that we know he has. He completely cleared on that. Just like he had completely cleared on acitretin for his lichen planus, he had a new condition. I switched treatment modalities and it worked. So it was you have to keep your doctor, your practitioner hat on. Don't get tunnel vision. So important with these patients. I do see a lot of prurigo and eczematous dermatitis in these patients. I feel very comfortable putting them on dupilumab if they need it. With all of the talks or discussions we're having today in terms of biologics and patients with active malignancy, I have a discussion with them that, look, these drugs are not trialed in patients with your condition. No drug company wants to do that trial, right? Any patient with active malignancy is often excluded in terms of getting these drugs approved. From an immunology perspective, I have ones that I feel very comfortable giving, but I am very clear that this is not something that I can tell them is FDA approved for their condition. Now, I'm hopeful that the longer we have oncodermatology, that maybe we can get some of those trials going. But I do understand drug companies' reticence to saying, oh, let's try our psoriasis drug in patients just with stage 4 cancer, right? So that's something that we're going to have to wait a few more years on. Psoriasis is common. That means psoriasis is common in patients on immunotherapy. What you're going to see, though, and what I would encourage you to think about as often the first line people seeing these patients is if somebody gets a metastatic cancer diagnosis, do not pull away all of their treatments that have been controlling their disease. Their disease is going to get worse. Then there's no way that they're going to be able to stay on immunotherapy or even start it, right? If somebody needed a biologic before, think about why did they need that biologic. Now, I will agree, our threshold for giving biologics in 2024 is much lower than it was 10 years ago. Somebody can get a biologic for a fairly low body surface area of disease. And maybe for that patient who just had some scalp psoriasis that wanted to try a biologic to see how it did, maybe they won't need to stay on a biologic while they have active malignancy. But I would have the discussion, okay? What I see so often is patients that come to me, they had psoriasis, their cancer was diagnosed, everybody panicked, pulled off all the treatments, and then they're like, well, why did my psoriasis flare when I went on this drug that can cause psoriasis? So you're kind of setting them up for failure if we react like that. This was a gentleman who was referred to me urgently on a trial because they thought he had eruptive psoriasis on this immunotherapy trial. When I talked to him, and fortunately I had some notes from like 5 years back, This is exactly how he had looked 5 years back. He had not changed at all. Just because somebody has psoriasis doesn't mean that you know that it's going to get worse. So a lot of times these patients are somebody who should talk to us first to say, like, look, it could get worse. It could stay about the same. We don't know. We need to follow you. So that way you're there and available. If they have a flare, you are there to be able to do something about it so they don't get their treatment interrupted. So I offered this guy a biologic, but he didn't really want one. He said, you know what? I've been doing fine. I'm fine with topicals. My itch is controlled. So I continued that, and I didn't push him to do a biologic. This is a woman who's very sick. She had metastatic esophageal carcinoma. She had had multiple trials, standard of care therapies, and was kind of on last line, last ditch efforts in a phase study on immunotherapy. And this was an acute eruption, came up very quickly. She's almost emaciated, so this is her back that you're seeing in the photo. And this evolved over the matter of a week, so she was an appropriate stat referral to my clinic. And I felt like it was psoriasiform because it was very well demarcated plaques. I think we can all agree about that. But then at the periphery, if you look, she has these really beautiful pustules. So this was actually pustular psoriasis, acute eruptive pustular psoriasis on immunotherapy. This is a photo of her chest that was going on at the same time too. So this is high grade severity. Honestly, this could be a 4 because psoriasis, pustular psoriasis, we know can be acutely dangerous for patients. I had a lot of discussions with her first day, like, I really think we need to go into the hospital. Like, this is something that we admit patients for, maybe do some cyclosporin, maybe do some wet wraps. She was so over it, which I respected. She had been on so many therapies, was even contemplating hospice at this point. She's like, I am not going into the hospital. And so this, you know, don't throw things at me, but this was a patient that I ended up putting on prednisone. Because I did not feel like I could control her disease in a way that was acutely safe and respect her wishes in another way. And obviously that's not my first choice, but it did work. And I don't know if any of you have tried to get a same-day biologic approval, but it's not that easy. And so, you know, when I give these, I've given this case at one of our AAD conferences, and somebody's like, well, why didn't you just put her on a, you know, an IL-23 inhibitor that day. And I'm like, well, you tell me how you're able to do that, and I would appreciate it. So that was obviously the goal long-term for this patient. And I told her we were going to do prednisone. It was going to be hard to get her off. But her risk-benefit was different, right, because she was at the end of her life. I was able to slowly taper off her prednisone, got her. Eventually, I think her insurance company would only let me work with an IL-17 inhibitor, and I got her clear. And she did end up deciding to go on hospice, but still came to see me even after she had made that decision, because this was one of the most impactful things that happened to her at the end of her life. And she was just so grateful to be able to stay out of the hospital and finish her life the way that she wanted to. So our ability to work with these patients, partner with them when they're going through something so intense, is just unmatched, in my opinion. So remember your CTCAE guidelines, what we covered at the beginning. These patients may end up on steroids. And one of my main goals is to let's not put all these patients on steroids. I know I just told you I put that patient on steroids. But my main goal is let's not put all these psoriasis patients on steroids. There's so much we can do. There's so many options out there for psoriasis patients. Again, this is off-label, not study approved, but oncodermatology preference is to start as specific as possible. I describe to my patients when we're blockading inflammation and psoriasis, there's the river and there's the tributaries. I'm trying to get as far downstream as possible because I believe that's the safest for them. So I try to start with something like an IL-23 inhibitor. If somebody's on a TNF inhibitor, maybe we should switch that if we can, okay? Because it's a lot more upstream. And I would not do something like a JAK inhibitor right now since we have so many other much more specific therapies for these patients. There are some retrospective data on this. About 23% of patients in one study had immunotherapy-associated psoriasis lead to discontinuation of treatment. And then we also have some data that shows retrospectively, again, patients that were on biologics did just fine. There are NCCN guidelines, so an oncologist, if you talk to them, may reference this. They're pretty primitive, So generally, it's better to get with expert. But if you're really up a creek, look at your NCCN guidelines on what are they telling oncologists to do about this, because then you at least know how to start that conversation. But you'll notice on all of these, once things get kind of over 30%, it's going to say, talk to a dermatologist. So then you're back at square one. I love treating bullous pemphigoid. I think that it's actually one of the more common things I see. What you should take away from this talk is it's one of the later things to develop in patients on immunotherapy. So we know kind of like classically when like lichenoid develops early, psoriasiform develops early. Bullous pemphigoid is late. That's like a year in, 6 months in. They've been on it for a while, and then they start getting itchy. Think about bullous pemphigoid even in patients without bullae. So if you get an immunotherapy patient that's super itchy, think about doing your antigen tests, your serologies, and then think about doing an immunofluorescence. This was a guy who lived in Florida. I was seeing him in Houston at the time. I looked at him and I was like, oh, this is bullous pemphigoid. You have like early bullous pemphigoid. And I hadn't taken care of many patients with this yet. And I said, you know, I really think like, this might get kind of bad. Like, I think that you might need, we can do some clobetasol. There's that New England Journal study that shows that patients with clobetasol did just as well as patients with oral steroids. So I offered him, but I said, you know, there's some interest in this drug like dupilumab for bullous pemphigoid. There's even an active study going on, not in cancer patients. But, you know, maybe that's something we should think about for you. And he's like, no, I'm on so many medicines. I don't want to do that right now. I'm going to go home. I'll just do some topical steroids. Well, the beauty of my chart, right, like I start getting from Florida like hyper, like five messages a day because he just exploded. And he was so itchy, so miserable. I was able to get him, I started right, obviously put him on steroids because we need to do damage control. But I thought he was going to need something else besides that. And I put him on dupilumab. And he had just an incredible clearance. I'm really looking forward to see how all that data comes out. But dupilumab is my first choice for my patients who have bullous pemphigoid. And I do find that usually even with a low body surface area, I need to start that conversation early. I would rather get it approved for them and then them say, like, actually, I don't really need this and not do it than like run into a wall, be behind, put them on chronic steroids, trying to get something approved. When we did our review, I used to work at MD Anderson, and when we did a review of all of our patients there, we found that bullous pemphigoid was extremely therapy limiting in terms of their immunotherapy, and that it almost all of them required a steroid sparing agent, something that wasn't prednisone long term for control of their disease. So that really shapes how I talk to these patients. Anybody with grade 2 or higher disease, I'm having that conversation with them. And you know, usually when we think of bullous pemphigoid, we think of our elderly female population, but in immunotherapy patients, we don't know why. It's more often male, but still skews age over 70. We talked about the latency, and we talked about dupilumab as well. Remember, for your DIF, you want to do non-lesional to see that IgG and C3 deposition. If you don't have access to immunofluorescence lab, consider doing your serum ELISA for BP180 and 230, but it's still positive, or it's still possible to get a positive immunofluorescence even if you have negative serum studies. Vitiligo. So we know that certain populations have higher quality of life impairment from vitiligo. So this affects who's going to come to see you for treatment of this. And a lot of my like type 1, type 2 skin patients, I'm kind of the one telling them, like, did you know you had vitiligo? And they're like, oh, I didn't notice that. And they're not that, I mean, at least I don't mean to generalize, but a lot of my patients in that category have not been as symptomatic, and so I have not been as aggressive about pursuing therapy. I have had patients with higher type skin or patients with one or two skin who are very symptomatic, and I'll have to be aggressive. Phototherapy, we'll use topical JAK inhibitors on low body surface areas, sort of the same framework that you would do for a normal vitiligo patient. One thing you can tell patients is there is good data in terms of vitiligo in our melanoma population specifically of having a positive tumor outcome with the development of vitiligo. So when they're going through something like that, if you can say, look, I know you're experiencing a lot with this, but this is actually a sign that your drug is working against your tumor, and sometimes that can really help with how they feel about their disease. But please remember that immunotherapy-associated vitiligo is not just restricted to melanoma patients. Any patient on immunotherapy can get vitiligo. And this is just a great case. I had this patient, he had renal cell carcinoma, and he'd had this tattoo for 30 years. And then a couple months into therapy on immunotherapy, he got itchy. And if you look, it's just absolutely beautiful. The red areas of his tattoo had this dermal plaque associated with them, right? And then you can even see at the inferior margin where he has those little papules. Those are all the red areas of his red ink tattoo, and there's little papules there. It really spares the green areas completely. And so I was like, oh, you got a tattoo reaction on immunotherapy. That's kind of cool. I biopsied it. He had granulomatous inflammation that was non-caseating. Then I got a little curious. I would always encourage you. I think it's always good, and when you're thinking about taking care of these people, just be a little bit curious, right? I looked through all of his prior path, and when he had had a metastatic disease resected in a femur a few months prior, and there was a little note on the pathology report that said, incidental note of non-caseating granulomas. And I was like, well, now we're in a whole different ballpark, right? This patient has non-caseating granulomas within a tattoo, within certain areas, and he has evidence of bone marrow involvement. So I did a really thorough physical exam. I found one papule on the left forehead that was also non-caseating granuloma. So this was actually a tip of the iceberg. This patient had sarcoidosis as a manifestation of his immunotherapy adverse event. That is such an important diagnosis to make, right? Because what does sarcoidosis do? It causes adenopathy. What are we doing in our patients with active malignancy? We're monitoring adenopathy. What can show up AVID on PET CT? So this is an important discussion to have with the oncology team. Like, look, if it looks like we're developing more Hilar disease, maybe we should stop and think about, do we have the right diagnosis? Is it really his renal cell, or is it sarcoidosis? So I did put this patient on Plaquenil. I did serial ILK to his red ink tattooed inflammation area. That's what was most symptomatic to him. He had a beautiful response. His tattoo reverted back to its sort of normal appearance. He used some topicals as well. And we were able to manage him, monitor his malignancy appropriately in the setting of both known diagnoses. And this is a scary case. This is what keeps us all up at night. His patient had been seen in clinic. I didn't meet her at this visit, but she was triaged as a lichenoid eruption. She's a little bit itchy, been on immunotherapy for breast cancer. But if you look, you see those two eroded areas there on the middle of her back? She actually had Nikolsky. And so this patient, 5 days later, shows up in the ER, and she looks like this. So this is toxic epidermal necrolysis. This is possible on immunotherapy. Again, it doesn't follow the same timeline. It's very challenging in a patient on immunotherapy because they might have been on therapy for quite some time. Now, what I always say is, like, if the patient was on immunotherapy and they got Bactrim 10 days earlier, don't give the patient Bactrim again, right? It's still most likely the Bactrim. And when we've done studies on our immunotherapy-associated TEN patients, there's some question of, is there this two-hit hypothesis? But if they got something that was like classically a precipitant of TEN, the thought is it's probably still that drug, right? But sometimes we see patients that had nothing like that, and it was probably just the immunotherapy. These are people where you're not trying to be like sort of cautious about immunosuppressing them in the setting of malignancy. You're trying to save their lives. They need to go to the hospital. You do whatever standard at your institution, or I do cyclosporin, but some people do Imbril. All stops are off, right? You need to save this person's life. But I think recognition, doing that Nikolsky, seeing if they have skin pain, so important in appropriate triage. This is not somebody I would rechallenge. This patient didn't have another likely precipitant, and I said, you know, this could kill her if we keep giving it to her. She did okay. She survived. She has a lot of scarring, but she actually improved within a week or two. And when we look at our immunotherapy TEN, they actually do a little bit better than what we expect, and so we're still getting more data on that. So I briefly want to just end treatment and rechallenging. Steroids we know are bad for immunotherapy, but sometimes you need them. I've talked a little bit about biologics. Be as specific as possible. That's definitely a discussion. I think if you're thinking about starting somebody on a new biologic, it's good to work with an interdisciplinary team because this is something where you can't expect the oncologist to know what to do. You need to have an opinion, okay? But it's definitely a discussion, so we're all on the same page. These are all the things I think about when I'm thinking about how do I treat an immunotherapy-associated eruption. How bad is it? Are they on a trial? What's the trajectory? I've taken care of a lot of these people. What do I know that their eruption's going to do? That's also the same thing I think about when we're rechallenging. Okay, there's a lot of overlap there. I just want to show you a couple more, I think just two more cases. This was a lady that I had who had, this is beautiful subacute cutaneous lupus. It's like textbook-worthy SCLE. But she had been put on immunotherapy as a last-line effort for cervical cancer. She'd also recently gotten terbinafine and a proton pump inhibitor. Okay, she had a Rho antibody. This is drug-induced SCLE. So what do, right? Well, we know that drug-induced SCLE, even if you remove the causative drug, it takes a while to make it get better. And it's often very refractory even to oral steroids. So I was able to do through all the normal things that we do to treat SCLE, get her down to a grade one. And then her oncologist calls me and says, you know, she really needs immunotherapy. This is a grade three eruption, so normally you'd be pretty cautious about rechallenging. But I feel pretty confident based on talking to her that this was really more related to her PPI and possibly the terbinafine. And so I said, you know what? We can tell her it may happen again, and we may have to go back on steroids again, but I'm also willing to try if she is. And she was like, yeah, let's do it. Rechallenged, no recurrence of rash. That also kind of should blow your mind, right? We've reprogrammed the immune system to be as active as possible and lead to autoimmunity. This is a patient with active cutaneous lupus. We rechallenge, it doesn't budge. There's still so much we don't know about these drugs. And then this was a 70-year-old. He'd been on prednisone for 3 months for this these red patches. They just would not go away. He was sent to me as a referral. What can we do? We need to get him off steroids. He hasn't been able to get his drug in so long. Well, again, don't get tunnel vision. Not everything that happens to these patients is because of the drug. I did a KOH, floridly positive. This patient had been on prednisone for 3 months for tinea. This has nothing to do with immunotherapy. I gave him 2 weeks of terbinafine, his rash is cured. He's able to go back on his treatment, everybody's happy. Make sure you keep your diagnostic hat on. There's some evidence about recurrence. I don't put a lot of stock in this because we don't have it diagnosis based yet. I wanna know like what's the recurrence rate if I rechallenge on for bullous pemphigoid, not just rash. There is some data out there. Again, I think it's pretty primitive. Everybody wants to know, is everything a good prognostic sign? There are some studies suggesting that it is. Again, I would put the caveat out there that these are from large databases. So what are they looking up as an immune-related adverse event? That's not a diagnosis code. They're looking up rash. You and I all know that not all rashes are created equal. Again, 10% of the patients that come to me to see me, they have stasis dermatitis. So I don't care what that means in terms of their immunotherapy. So I think some more prospective data is needed. But there have been signals that it's a good prognostic sign. Thank you so much. This is my email. I hope I got you excited about this field. And I appreciate the opportunity to talk with you. One question, how did you get coverage for insurance for Dupixent? You know, I've been doing this for about 5 years now. I had a lot of trouble at the beginning, but there are studies now showing dupilumab efficacy in bullous pemphigoid patients in terms of case series. And then I also point out that it's under active investigation in a phase 3 trial. And so I have been able to get it approved, usually with appeal, but even sometimes, a few times now, without appeal. So I'm really hoping that that's more and more possible as we get more data. Would you also consider apremilast? Yes, I just think that in terms of like what I normally do for psoriasis, that I know that an IL-23 inhibitor may work better, has better data to start with. So apremilast, if somebody's already on it and it's working for them, I would keep them on it. I would be okay with that. I would probably choose a few other things first if they had a severe psoriasiform eruption before I move to apremilast, though, in my treatment ladder. I have patients referred to derm from onc that have developed rash after immunotherapy. Oncology is looking for my recommendation for continuation or discontinuation. When do you recommend discontinuation? So if you think the eruption's dangerous, if you think it's severely impairing their quality of life and you don't have any way to improve that, like think about, is there ways that you can intervene on this rash that could get control and then rechallenge? Then yes, I would say do that, but I'd say like give me a few weeks to get that going, right? And then would I do a biopsy? I think about that like I normally would as a dermatologist. There's some things that when you look at it, you're like, a biopsy is not going to help me with that, right? Like a small patch on the abdomen, you're going to treat that the same way either way. Now, if I'm trying, and I don't biopsy like psoriasis, if I'm trying to make a case for like bullous pemphigoid or something where I think we can really rely on the biopsy, for sure, I do it. You will also find when you're working with oncologists, oncology is such a path-driven field, right? They are not going to start any treatment without a path diagnosis because that's appropriate, right? They're not going to treat breast cancer without a path report showing breast cancer. So you may have a little more pushback than you're used to in terms of discussing, like, look, a biopsy is actually not that helpful for a lot of these eczematous rashes. Biopsy is also low risk. So if the patient wants one, the oncologist wants one, I can say, look, it might have limited utility, but I don't mind doing one, okay? Some biologics are cautioned with history of malignancy. Well, that's why I try to be as specific as possible. And I still fight this, like, regularly. If we don't do anything, it's definitely going to get worse. They may have that condition forever. It may not be controlled, and their cancer won't be treated. So my alternative is still, I think, a positive. But again, I'm not going to start by using something that's as upstream or very immunosuppressive. I'm not trying to rush to like mycophenolate. But if you look at the patients that get autoimmune hepatitis on immunotherapy, what do they start with? Mycophenolate. So I think like we should remember we actually have the benefit of having fairly specific drugs. And if you look at the malignancy signals in patients on like the IL-23 inhibitor trials, it's not as concerning as some of the other things like a JAK inhibitor. Okay? All right. Thank you guys so much. Really appreciate it.